1280 Ralph.
Stand by for a wild ride tonight on the Paranet Continuum. We're going to sail right into the middle of the night, if you will, with a guest, very interesting guest. And some of you people out there who are above the age of 40 will probably recall some of these events. But, you know, let's kind of recap. In towns throughout America, they came face-to-face with the ultimate evil. August 1969, Sharon Tate and six others are massacred northwest of Los Angeles by followers of Charles Manson. October 1974, Arliss Perry is the victim of a perverse ritual murder in a chapel on the Stanford University campus in California. February 1977, Fred Cowan murders six people before killing himself during a day-long siege at the Neptune Moving Company in New Rochelle, New York. July 1976 through August of 77. New York City is terrorized as the Son of Sam murders leave six dead and seven wounded. February 1978, John Carr is found shot under questionable circumstances in Minot, North Dakota. October 1978, John's brother, Michael Carr, dies in a suspicious car accident in New York City. December 1981, Joseph Carroza is shot twice with a .38 caliber revolver in New Rochelle, New York. July 1983, the long-dead corpse of missing movie producer Roy Radin turns up in a California desert. And November 1984, 16-year-old Teresa Fusco is abducted, raped, strangled, and dumped nude in a wooded area in Lynbrook, Long Island, and the evil one to kill again. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Gear Magazine, which has just come out with a piece titled The Ghost of 77, was written by my guest tonight, Maury Terry, who published a book called The Ultimate Evil. Now, Maury Terry is credited by law enforcement officials as being an expert on the Son of Sam case and on cult killings. He has researched and written more than 40 articles on the topic and has served as associate producer and on-camera host for five nationally syndicated television specials based on his work. And Terry won the 1982 United Press International's Enterprise Award for investigative reporting. He has also acted as a consultant in the Atlanta child murders investigation that occurred back in the 80s. And, of course, The Ultimate Evil was his very first book, and it's a pleasure to welcome to the program tonight, Maury Terry. Good morning, Maury.
Good morning, Michael. Nice to be with you.
I want to thank you for being with me at this ungodly hour over there in New York.
Well, payback for the people in Denver who were very nice to me back in
well, great.
1987 in the Rose Bowl, January the 25th. I'm a New York Giants fan.
So well, excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the program. As I told you earlier today when I talked to you, you're to be commended for your persistence and your perseverance in this very bizarre case that, as far as I'm concerned, I'm sure as far as you're concerned, has never been truly amiably resolved.
It has not been amiably resolved. What the case needs is a grand jury, and if a grand jury can be convened, I believe that the case at that point will be resolved. I think the case is basically solved. I think there's enough evidence to bring it to a grand jury, and hopefully that will happen at some point.
Okay. Now, before we get to the part about the article that appeared in Gear Magazine this month, let's go back a little bit in time here and kind of frame this for us. I started off by mentioning some of the trail of bodies, if you will, going back to 69 to Sharon Tate. Now, I know Sharon Tate was not involved directly with Berkowitz, but can you establish for us what took place and kind of give us a background on what happened?
In the Tate case?
No, actually in the Son of Sam case.
Oh, sure. Between July of 1976 and August of 1977, a series of homicides, attacks with nighttime attacks occurred throughout the boroughs of New York City. There were eight different incidents, a total of 13 victims, six dead and seven wounded.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the attacks occurred in Lover's Lane, all the victims were shot with 44 caliber guns. Many were in lovers' lanes. Others were young girls walking down the street by themselves, so on and so forth. The victims were all young, white, mostly female. And the it evolved into the biggest case in New York history, and one of the biggest in modern American history, and became known as the Son of Sam shootings. And on August 10th of 77, a 24-year-old postal clerk by the name of David Berkowitz was arrested outside his apartment building in suburban Yonkers, just north of New York City. And Berkowitz confessed to doing all of the shootings and to doing them all by himself. And at the time when he was arrested, he claimed that a neighbor's dog, this may register with people, you know, was really a demon and gave him the orders to kill and so on and so forth. And that's why he did it. And there was no trial. Berkowitz avoided a trial, pled guilty, was sent away. And that was supposedly the end of it, only it wasn't. I began an investigation of it almost immediately after Berkowitz was arrested. And within, almost 2 years' time, I began writing articles for the Gannett newspaper chain in Westchester County, north of New York City. And then the district attorney of Queens County, in which five of the eight Son of Sam incidents occurred, reopened the case. And then went public stating he believed that Berkowitz, in fact, was part of a conspiracy. And that is sort of it in a nutshell. There have been a lot of developments over the years since then. Most recently, which the Gear magazine article covers, is that in 1996, the police in Berkowitz's hometown of Yonkers reopened the case quietly, ran a quiet investigation for 2 years, determine if Berkowitz was in fact part of a conspiracy that was concocted in their jurisdiction, and they have now determined that there is evidence indeed that he was part of such a conspiracy, and have recommended that the case go to a grand jury and the probe to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it stands as of this minute.
As of this minute. Now, how did your background as a journalist? Is that correct?
Yes.
How did you get? How did you start getting involved in this and realizing that something just wasn't ringing true?
Like many, many people in metropolitan New York back then, you couldn't avoid the case. It was all over the front pages. It dominated the headlines,
mm-hmm.
TV news, radio news, day in and day out. And it was such a huge case. And I just became interested in it. And when Berkowitz got arrested, and a couple of comments that he allegedly made to the cops leaked out, things just didn't seem to add up. Like he would have had to have been in two places at once in order to be the shooter. The police had released a series of artist drawings,
mm-hmm.
of the so-called Son of Sam, and some of them were widely, widely, widely different than Berkowitz. And I started out with those kinds of troubles on my mind and started making inquiries, and within a short time I came up with some evidence that just convinced me to keep going,
mm-hmm.
and that led into other people in the case.
This is a very interesting case, I guess, because mostly I think because of the implications and the things that were involved. Now, going back to the beginning when I started off by, you know, going over the trail of bodies, if you will, what is the connection, or what was the connection between, you know, when you mentioned in your book Sharon Tate and the six that were massacred northwest of Los Angeles by followers of Charles Manson?
As it turns out, and this is the last thing I was looking for when I got into this case, as it turns out, Berkowitz was a member of a very sophisticated cult group that had come over from England in 1967. It was a satanic cult group, an Armageddon cult. It was known as the Process Church of the Final Judgment. Process landed in America in 67, established chapters in a number of U.S. cities,
mm-hmm.
And were very active in California. And there is quite strong evidence that Charlie Manson himself had joined a Process cell in California and in 1968. And here we go into 1977, 9 years later, and Berkowitz had also joined a Process operation in New York. So on different coasts at different times. The evidence is very, very strong that both Manson and Berkowitz had belonged to the same organization.
Mm-hmm. And the other interesting thing, too, that I think is brought up also in your article, the recent article in Gear Magazine, is the possible connection between the Process Church and Sirhan Sirhan, who has been convicted and is serving time for the assassination of Robert Kennedy.
Yes, I've seen Ed Sanders, who back in the early 70s wrote an excellent book on the Manson murders called The Family, Vincent Bugliosi having written the other one called Helter Skelter.
Mm-hmm.
Sanders had unearthed some information strongly pointing toward the involvement of the Process in the Manson case. And he had also heard things about the possibility that Sirhan Sirhan had, in fact, dabbled in Process activities. I found the same thing through a series of reports that were given to me to read. They were reports from the INS, in fact. And in it, it was stated that Sirhan Sirhan, that witnesses had told the L.A. authorities that Sirhan had attended at least one Process sex ritual in the Los Angeles area. And there was another report that a Process member was actually a chef or a cook or an assistant cook in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel, which is, as we all know, is where Robert Kennedy was shot, right in that kitchen in that hotel.
As I recall, and I don't know if I remember this correctly, so maybe you may know and correct me if I'm wrong, did not Robert Kennedy have dinner at the Tate House the night that he was killed?
Actually, I believe it was at the beachfront home in Malibu of Peter Lawford, who was a Kennedy brother-in-law, and that Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski were among the dinner guests.
I see, okay. Which is kind of an interesting, I guess, an interesting coincidence.
I think it is a coincidence. It seems to be a coincidence.
Yeah. Maury, let's go kind of talk about the Process, where it comes from, where it came from, where it had its origins, and how they got ever so entwined in our culture to be able to do what they've done.
The Process, which still exists today under another name, there are a number of groups on the internet these days calling themselves the Process or Son of Process, but that's not the real Process. The real Process went underground, changed its name several times, and exists today under a benign name.
Mm-hmm.
But it began in 1963 as an offshoot of Scientology. The head of the Process, Robert de Grimston, and his wife, Mary Ann, in London, had been mid-level officials, I'd say, or counselors in Scientology, and had a falling out with L. Ron Hubbard, and went off to start their own group, which they called Compulsion Analysis at the beginning. And they recruited among some friends of theirs, and some they were looking, like all cults do, for the wealthy recruits.
Mm-hmm.
And they gathered a group about them of such people in London. And it started to grow, and eventually they changed their name to the Process Church of the Final Judgment because they were preaching Armageddon at the millennium,
mm-hmm.
Hence the Final Judgment, the name of the Final Judgment. And in 1967, a group of Process members came over to America, landed in America, established chapters first in New Orleans, then where they incorporated as an occult church, and that's right in their corporate papers, so readily available,
mm-hmm.
and branched out. Into Haight-Ashbury, then along the Sunset Strip, the perfect place in New York City's Greenwich Village, the perfect places where they could find the type of young, the hippie element and all the rebellious young people that they were looking to recruit. And they arrived at a perfect time. It was the era of anti-Viet war or non-war demonstrations. You had the free love, the Timothy Leary's Turn On, Tune In, Drop Out,
mm-hmm.
Rebellion against all authority, et cetera, et cetera. And Process had fertile ground to plow in the counterculture of American youth of the late 1960s.
Particularly up there at Berkeley.
Yes, they were. They were. They did. They had a chapter, and they had a. They were living right in Haight-Ashbury, and trying to recruit around Berkeley. And it was. They had an address on Cole Street in the Haight, and they were only a block or so from where Manson was residing at the same time. And that was certainly his first exposure to them.
I find this all very fascinating because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, these places and these locations and the people that were, you know, circulating around all of these things, they all feed into this in one way or the other.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Process also was up in Cambridge, Massachusetts there.
Around Harvard.
Right around Harvard. Again, they knew right where to go to get the kind, to try to recruit the kinds of people that that they were looking for, where they, figuring, of course, where they would have the most success.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Orleans, they were right in the French Quarter.
In the French Quarter?
In New Orleans.
In New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, well, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we'll get more into the into how they got entrenched in New York and how Berkowitz got involved with them and what led to all of these bizarre, horrific murders. And, again, this is a very interesting story. My guest is Maury Terry. We're talking to him about some late developments in the Son of Sam case. The Yonkers Police Department concludes a two-year investigation that concludes that there was indeed a conspiracy. And David Berkowitz did not act alone. He was not the lone 44 caliber killer, as some people called him. Yeah, 303-860-1280, 303-860-1280, pound 1280 if you're a cellular AirTouch customer. We'll be right back after this. I'm Michael Corbin. You're listening to the Paranet Continuum.
Not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
What you can do is enter Gus and Jensen's resignation contest. All you have to do is listen to the show weekdays from 2 to 6, and when Gus and Tom tell you, give them a ring at 860-1280. Give the exact day and hour you think the president will utter the words,
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Duh, we already knew that. The Gus and Jensen resignation contest. Call in, you pick the exact time and date you think the president will resign. It's easy. Stay tuned to the Gus and Jensen show. For more information,
I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
The only thing we have to fear is
Denver's Talk Alternative 1280 Ralph.
Here are general rules for all 1280 Ralph contests. You can win only once within a 30-day period. If you win again within 30 days, you forfeit the second prize. If you win a prize valued over $600, you and your household cannot win another prize valued over $600 for 1 year. Prizes must be picked up within 30 days at the Ralph Studios. You must show a valid ID to claim them. Prizes are not transferable and not redeemable for cash. Winners are responsible for all applicable taxes. All contestants agree as a condition of entry that 1280 Ralph can publicize your name or voice on the air. Ralph is not responsible for lost mail entries or for telephone equipment failure. Get a complete list of rules at the Ralph Studios. And good luck from 1280 Ralph.
Ruth Chris Steakhouse, Denver's home of serious steaks, is also the United States number one restaurant. This prestigious award, given by the Robb Report, is just one more reason why Denver residents and visitors alike make Ruth's Chris their choice for fine dining. Ruth's Chris is open 7 days a week from 4:30 to 11:30 p.m., serving 100% prime beef, succulent seafood, unique appetizers and specials, all complemented by Ruth's award-winning wine list. If your dining experience is enhanced with a fine cigar, you'll find no better atmosphere than Ruth's Chris, voted Denver's preeminent establishment for cigar aficionados. For your convenience, we feature free valet parking, along with personalized service. Just ask for Jeff, Mark, or Dale to assist you with any special needs. For the dining experience of a lifetime, come to Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, located at 1445 Market Street. At 15th and Market, call 446-2233 for reservations and enjoy.
1280 Ralph.
Comrie picking up the loose puck, skates behind the net again, looking for Robertson, crashing on the right side, sends it in front, tipped up, shot, score!
College hockey is the best, and for decades, the city of Denver's home team for college athletics has been the University of Denver Pioneers. They've played a tough and gritty brand of hockey that is expected in the WCHA, and this season there will be no exception. Be there for all of the action this season as the Pioneers do battle with some of college hockey's powerhouses, like Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Colorado College for the WCHA title and the coveted Division I championship. Witness the hard-hitting, fast action of college hockey, University of Denver hockey, by buying tickets for this season. When you do that, you can buy the 1999 season at the same price. And you will have access to some of the best seats in the house at the new state-of-the-art Ritchie Center. The University of Denver Pioneers Hockey, college hockey at its best.
For tickets, call today at 303-871-2336. That's 303-871-2336. The game is on with Denver's home team, the University of Denver Pioneers Hockey.
Hello, Umpteen Hatch Incorporated.
Yes, I'd like to speak with the president.
Speaking.
Really? Oh. Well, you know, actually, then I should probably talk to your chief financial officer.
Oh, well, that'd be me, too.
If you own a small business, you can open a U.S. Bank Simply Business account and pay no opening fees.
Come to think of it, let me speak to a sales consultant.
Okay, I can help you there.
With no opening fees on accounts for small business, now is the perfect time to switch to U.S. Bank.
Change my mind. Put me through to shipping
and receiving? Sure thing. What can I do for you?
U.S. Bank. We have all the tools to help your business run better, no matter how small it is.
Maybe I should speak to someone in R&D.
That's me.
Make that... accounting.
Me again.
Oh, boy. How about the guy who makes sure you have enough of those little plastic stir sticks for the coffee?
3-inch or 4-inch?
Doesn't matter.
I handle them both.
Great. Let me talk to you.
For details, stop by your local U.S. bank or call 1-888-746-2870, extension 500. You must apply before November 20th, 1998. U.S. Bank. Your needs, our tools. Member FDIC.
Tastes great and less filling. 1280 Ralph.
We're talking with the author of The Ultimate Evil and a recent article in Gear magazine by that title, The Ghost of 77, Maury Terry. This man was jailed for the Son of Sam murders that paralyzed New York, but did he really act alone? I'm referring to David Berkowitz, of course. A new police investigation may finally bring out the whole horrific truth, and we're talking with again with Maury Terry, who's in New York and who has been investigating this for many years, and through his persistence and perseverance is... hopefully going to bring about, as he mentioned, a grand jury investigation, which may, of course, blow the lid off of this whole thing once and for all and bring it to an amiable close. Welcome back, Maury.
Welcome back. Nice to be here again, Michael.
Thank you. Now, let's talk about the reason I want to kind of talk about this, too, because I think it has some relevance to today and some of the activities that we see in our culture today. And as Berkowitz mentioned on the A&E piece that you interviewed him in, he was under the influence of some kind of mind control. And is that correct?
Well, to the extent that that he was like many young people, not that they turn into killers,
mm-hmm.
but there were many young people out there wandering around looking to belong to something. And it's a very old cliche, you've heard it many times, but when somebody's hungry, they'll take the bread from who's ever there to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Berkowitz was drifting about, and he was vulnerable to the rap that was laid on him all about how great the occult was, and it was a special thing to be a part of, and he was vulnerable enough to accept all of this. And as he did put it to me, once you get sucked into it, before too long, the tide's carrying you out to sea, and there's no way back to the shore, no matter how hard you may try to get back there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened to him. There were a few factors in his life that made him susceptible to this, and they were able to get him to go out and believe in the religiosity part of this.
Right.
I mean, some of these people were in it for their own reasons, but Berkowitz and a number of others really believed in the religious side of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought they were on some sort of divine mission when they were out there doing these things.
It's incredible.
And this was all part of the process rap. The process people, if one knows their background, they are not the low-level people of society at all. When they came over from England, you know, we're talking about university-educated people who led the process. You had architects, accountants, couple of people with stage backgrounds and so on and so forth. Very, very intelligent people. And the problem is that they were also very bent and perverted themselves and lusted after power. And their idea was to recruit the David Berkowitzes of this world to go out and do their dirty work. At the same time, this devil stuff was really on the surface. They used it as a tool. But they're also operating a criminal enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
They were into providing young kids to the wealthy for sex parties and so on and so forth. And they had their connections and their hooks and their tie-ins and their ability to blackmail down the road some pretty kinky wealthy people. And they had friends in high places, in other words, and they provided a service to those friends. And so when they needed favors, they were able to get them. And as time has gone by over the years, as I've learned, we come to learn a lot more about how this Son of Sam slash process operation worked, it's become very, very clear why they were able to get away with this in New York and why when David Berkowitz got arrested and said, oh, a dog barked and I did it and the lid went on the case, it's very, very obvious why that was allowed to happen, why there was no investigation to follow up on it, because Berkowitz's confession had more holes in it than you would find in a barrel of Swiss cheese,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't care.
And we're going to get to that probably before we get done with you tonight. We're going to get to that those reasons because, as you mentioned, they had their hooks into some very high level people.
They did indeed. And this, of course, I didn't know until the last couple of years how high up it went.
You know, that's very, very interesting. And I'll tell you, if I may quote the last two paragraphs of your article, I think that's the most chilling thing I've read in a long time. It says, the process, meanwhile, under a new name and a socially acceptable cover, as you just mentioned, is still functioning in 1998. Records show that the group has acquired millions of dollars in vast real estate holdings along the way in its quest to inspire Armageddon in time for its professed witching hour, the millennium. In other words, the process, to borrow a haunting phrase from a Son of Sam letter, is, quote, still here, like a spirit roaming the night. And that's chilling. You mentioned earlier that it's under a different name, a benign name. Is it a name that we would recognize?
It's a name that some people might recognize. I wish I could reveal it, but for obvious reasons I can't.
But you say it's benign. It's something that nobody would ever suspect. Hello? What happened there? I don't know. Okay. We still on the air? Yes, we are. Okay, we're going to get him back. We're going to find out what happened to the connection. That was very, very odd, to say the least. While Brian is getting him back on. By the way, our number is 303-860-1280, 303-860-1280. And one of the things here we got here that he's got in the article is that it mentions, you know, numerous names of people that have died as a result of this whole thing. And, you know, it's very, 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 very odd. Let's see if we've got to get him back in here. And I think we do have him. Again, our number is 303-860-1280, 303-860-1280. And we do indeed have him back. Let's try it back again. Maury, are you there?
Yes, Michael.
What happened? Do we know?
I have no idea. From where I was sitting, the line just went dead.
Yeah, it just clicked off.
Just clicked off.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, let's go to, let's discuss the part about, I guess, where you entered into it with the first chapter of your book, The Ultimate Evil, was Satan at Stanford. There was a murder at Stanford of a young woman that was seemingly unconnected to all the goings-on in New York.
Yeah, her name was Arliss Perry. She was a native of Bismarck, North Dakota, young Christian bride, been a cheerleader and a member of various Christian organizations in Bismarck, married her hometown sweetheart named Bruce Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Ironic story about Bruce, too.
Mm-hmm.
They then relocated to Palo Alto, where Bruce was studying at Stanford University to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were only on the campus about 6 weeks when Arliss was found murdered in the Stanford Memorial Church. He was killed after midnight. Actually, it was this is almost the anniversary. It was the night of October 12th, 13th, 1974.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 5 years thereafter, the case was unsolved. I mean, technically, it's still unsolved. And Santa Clara Sheriff's Office thought they were searching for a local sexual psychopath. And then David Berkowitz, in 1979 from prison, dropped a note in which he mentioned some specifics about the Arliss Perry case, including polygraph keys, information that only the police would know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got a hold of this letter, I had never heard of Arliss Perry, never heard of the case at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we soon found out what it was all about, and it turned out that the information Berkowitz had was absolutely correct and on the money. And I now know how Berkowitz came to know about that. He was at a cult meeting in New York in 1977 at a house in the Bronx, I believe, on City Island.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people who had been involved in Arliss Perry's killing was imported to New York to take part in Son of Sam killings and stood up at this cult meeting in this house and started bragging about the killing and had Arliss's picture and described what had happened to her. And Berkowitz, who has a remarkable memory, remembered that, and that's how he got the information that he later put into that letter.
Now, did anybody determine, I don't recall from reading the book, did anybody determine why Arliss Perry was selected?
Arliss Perry, Berkowitz didn't know the motive,
mm-hmm.
but he knew there was a motive, that they went after her for a reason.
There was, it wasn't just a random
thing. No, it was not. Arliss Perry had done something in her hometown of Bismarck to anger some people who were involved in a chapter of the cult group in North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And when she left to go to Stanford University or to accompany her groom to Stanford University, they just didn't drop it. They tailed her to California, located where she was living in an apartment on the campus,
mm-hmm.
and stalked her for a couple of weeks and set out to get her.
Now, you mentioned earlier her husband had nothing to do with this, correct?
No. I mean, obviously her husband was the first suspect. The way this happened was they had an argument the night of the murder in the apartment, and she went out to take a walk went to the church where she often went since she was a religious person. But, of course, Bruce was the first suspect,
mm-hmm.
when they finally found the body. But very ironic about Bruce Perry. Bruce Perry went on to become a psychiatrist.
Really?
And in the Waco case a few years ago,
yeah,
Bruce Perry is now connected to Baylor University. And Bruce Perry was one of the doctors who was counseling the young kids who had been released from the Waco compound by Koresh before the federal government assaulted and killed all those people.
Wow.
And Bruce Perry is, I don't know whether he's in a state of denial or what, but from what I understand, he appears at conferences just downplaying occult crime in general in the United States. And I just want to, when this information gets back to me, it surprises me, and I just write it off to, you know, still a strong sense of denial,
mm-hmm.
about what really happened to his bride.
Wow. Hold that thought, Maury. We'll go to take another break. When we come back, we'll delve more into this interesting case. Maury Terry is my guest. We're talking about The Ultimate Evil, the book that he wrote back in the early 80s, I believe it was, and of course, his recent article in Gear Magazine concerning late developments in the Son of Sam case. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Have you ever dreamed of owning a beautiful grand piano? The distinctive sound, style, and performance can be yours during the 99th anniversary Grand Piano Festival at Joe and Ofrio Piano Company. Hi, Tom Jensen here. Stop in today to see the greatest selection and amazing sale prices on the complete family of Onofrio pianos. Choose from Mason and Hamlin, the world's finest piano since 1854, or Baldwin, America's best-selling piano, the unique Chickering Grands, or the affordably priced Wurlitzer Grand. Perhaps the rich European sound of Petrov is the piano for you. All are on sale this weekend. Onofrio also has a large selection of used grand pianos. Select from Steinway, Baldwin, Yamaha, and many other famous brands. Regardless of what you purchase, all are covered by Onofrio's full warranty. They have 99 years of experience in customer satisfaction. The Onofrio's 99th Anniversary Grand Piano Festival. Joe Onofrio Piano Company, 1332 South Broadway, 7 blocks south of I-25 on Broadway. And tell Joe that Tom Jensen recommends Onofrio.
1280 Ralph.
Are you tired of counting sheep when you should be asleep? Stop by Intimax today and experience a new Genesis or Sanctuary variable support air or fluid adjustable suspension mattress and what it can do for you. When you take a look at a new Genesis or Sanctuary variable support flotation system, you will find more of the stuff that dreams are made of. And a quick stop at Intimax will assure you that a new Genesis or Sanctuary sleep system offers you the most important, most natural comfort therapy and orthopedic support that is available today. With a new bed from Intimax, you can rest assured that there is no end to the specialized sleep surface choices you can create. Every type of bed that's available in the state, and it's all under the Intimax rooftop, you'll find a bed that is just right for you. Stop by Intimax today and send your sheep on a permanent vacation. Or you can always doze off with a good long book, but the sheep are counting on you. Call 298-0230, 298-0230, and they'll tell you exactly how to get there. And when you get there, make sure you tell them Gus sent you.
Cash flow is the lifeblood of any business, especially smaller businesses. So it's nice to have blue chip accounts receivable. They alone don't pay the bills. Nice accounts receivable position will make your balance sheet look good, but you can't eat your balance sheet. You need the cash. The time lapse from invoicing to collections is critical. National Factoring Services is a service designed to solve this dilemma. National Factoring's specialty is helping businesses with short-term cash flow problems, with growth that current financing cannot handle. They help businesses with no established credit and those with the inability to comply with bank loan requirements. National Factoring finances qualified accounts receivable in a way that maximizes flexibility, minimizes cost, and keeps you in business. Call for more information on how National Factoring can help you. That's National Factoring Services. For commercial accounts receivable financing, turning those accounts receivable into cash right now. You can call them at 303-224-9600. That's 303-224-9600. National Factoring Services. Call today.
Thanks to voice messaging from U.S. West, people have found lots of new uses for their old answering machines.
Looks like a good spot. Toss the anchor.
What anchor?
The answering machine.
Because unlike answering machines, voice messaging makes it easy to get the message every time.
Honey, where's the hammer?
I don't know.
Never mind. I'll just use the answering machine.
With voice messaging, there are no tapes to jam, no machine to break down.
Hey, Mom, we invented answering machine bowling. That's nice, dear.
And with voice messaging, you never miss an important call, even when you're on the other lines.
Here, Sparky. Fetch.
Order now and get free activation, plus your first month of service free. Just call U.S. West at 1-800-982-3525.
Oh! Message erased.
Call 1-800-982-3525 today. Voice messaging from U.S. West. Life's better here.
It could be. It might be. It is! 1280 Ralph.
My guest is Maury Terry. We're talking about David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, and we are finding out, as Maury Terry has maintained for many years, that David Berkowitz did not act alone. We're going to find out tonight why David Berkowitz why Maury Terry says that David Berkowitz did not act alone. It's because there's some very interesting developments over the years, as you've heard Maury mention. And Maury, we've got about probably about 3-4 minutes before the network news. Let's talk about how your investigation went beyond Arliss Perry, what took you to North Dakota, because that's a bizarre story as well.
Well, the North Dakota connection at first was because of one of the people who Berkowitz has now named as a co-conspirator and actually as one of the shooters in the case.
Mm-hmm.
His name was John Carr. He was the son of Berkowitz's neighbor, Sam Carr, hence the term Son of Sam. literally John Carr and his brother Michael were the sons of Sam.
Mm-hmm.
And John Carr surfaced as one of my, an immediate suspect of mine in the case right after Berkowitz was arrested,
mm-hmm.
because of an alias used in the Son of Sam letter that happened to be John Carr's nickname. And if, as the police maintained at the time, Berkowitz didn't know the Carrs at all, well, how would he know the nickname of a guy who spent all his time in North Dakota?
Mm-hmm.
But
correct.
He did. And so I went looking for John Carr, and 6 months after Berkowitz was arrested, I found John Carr because he was shot dead in Minot, North Dakota, in his girlfriend's apartment on Minot Air Force Base. They first called it a probable homicide, then changed it to an apparent suicide, and then it went back to a most likely homicide. And I can tell you it's been proven that it was a homicide.
So
somebody went out to shut John Carr up within months of Berkowitz's arrest, and Berkowitz has since told me that John Carr was the weakest link because he had a bad drug and alcohol problem. And if anybody was the likely one to crack, it would have been John Carr. Of course, Berkowitz was in jail at the time,
mm-hmm.
but he said that's why they would have gone after John, because he was the weakest.
Now, where did Berkowitz get the idea to use the dog? Was that
that was concocted by him and a few of his accomplices near the very, very end of the case, shortly before he got arrested, and that was just to lay the foundation for an insanity defense, which Berkowitz later, before he pled guilty in court,
mm-hmm.
you know, abandoned that and admitted it was nonsense. But that's the thing, you know, first impressions count, and that's the thing that thing with the dog has stuck in the minds of many people for many years. I mean, it's the most ludicrous story,
absolutely,
that you could imagine, and why the authorities accepted it is beyond belief, and it just leads into other areas. But, you know, interesting thing about the dog, if there's a minute, the name of the dog was Harvey was the dog's name,
mm-hmm.
the talking dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, interestingly enough, and this shows you how devious some of these people are, they got, you know, in that movie,
uh-huh.
James Stewart talked to the rabbit, talking rabbit, the invisible rabbit,
right.
that only James Stewart could see. The rabbit's name was Harvey.
Oh, no.
That's where the idea came from.
So they just grabbed this stuff out of the air. Now,
absolutely. That's exactly what they did.
Wow. And
the biggest, you know, and the so-called New York's finest and all was suckered into this like they were, you know, the Hardy Boys at the age of 2 or 3 and had no knowledge about anything. It's just pathetic.
That's wild. Well, Murray, we're at the top of the hour, and we're going to go to network news, and got enough time to go grab some coffee, and
we'll do it.
We'll be back here at 6 after, and we'll rejoin you. Okay.
Hey.
All right. Thanks a lot, Murray. Stand by, and as I mentioned, we're going to go to news, and then we've got another exciting hour with Murray Carey coming up next. So stay tuned. I'm Michael Corbin. This is the Paranet Continuum.
KRRF Denver. Expect the unexpected from Denver's Talk Alternative, 1280 Ralph.